What's up, everyone? I'm your podcast host, Chinette, and you're listening to the Hopkins Hacks podcast. Everyone has a unique journey of exploration at Hopkins, and our podcast puts your favorite faculty, alumni, and students in the hot seat to share their experiences and takeaways. We discuss the four key pillars of college life, including work, relationship, health, and play. Welcome to part one of this episode of Hopkins Hacks, where we explore the education, PhD route, and humanities at Hopkins. Our guest for today is Rhea, a Hopkins alumni currently doing her PhD at Cornell. In this episode, Rhea shares her insights on finding your niche within the humanities program, how to best use the resources available, and how to establish a strong network. Rhea takes us through her journey of exploring beyond the Hopkins bubble, about tackling personal insecurities and imposter syndrome, providing valuable advice for fellow students facing similar challenges. Let's dive into the discussion.
My name is Rhea Golano. I graduated in May with the class of 2022. I'm from South Dakota, but I was an Air Force kid, so my family moved around a lot, both nationally within the US and also internationally. I entered Hopkins as a writing seminars major with a theater arts minor, and I ended up graduating as a psychology major with a theater arts minor. So I guess that one thing stayed a little bit consistent, even though my plans pretty drastically changed throughout my time there. And this fall, actually next month, I'll be starting my PhD at the Cornell Department of Communication, where I will be studying the psychological effects of technology use, especially in social media and VR environments, as well as how these technologies can support people with disabilities and chronic illnesses.
That's awesome. Congratulations. So I was curious to ask you, you mentioned earlier that you were started off with writing seminars, and then you then shifted over into psychology by the time you graduated. Can you tell us a bit more about your academic journey and what were the decisions that you had to make along that journey?
Yeah, for sure. I guess for my whole life, I knew that I was going to be a writer. So when I came to college, it was a no-brainer. Of course, I'm going to take creative writing classes. I'm going to do everything I can to become a novelist. That said, when I got to Hop, I noticed a few things first. One thing is that I've realized in my high school curriculum, we didn't have very much opportunity to take AP classes. In fact, my school had cut all AP classes except for AP literature, which I felt like really contributed to my decision to stick with writing and not add another major or minor or focus area besides theater, which I'd been doing extracurricularly in high school. So when I got to Hopkins, I saw all of these resources for research. And I realized that I wanted to branch out a bit because for me, writing was something that I had always done and I knew I would continue doing, even if it wasn't something that I was necessarily majoring in. So I wanted to explore and I ended up joining Dr. Jeff Bowen's psychology lab. It's one of the only social psychology labs on campus. And yeah, it was great. I went in for an interview. I was like, hey, Dr. Bowen, I write rom-coms and I want to study them in a researchy setting so it can help inform my character development, relationship development in my books. But it turned out to be a calling for me. And I ended up just really getting into psychology. And I've still done writing on the side because Hopkins is great in the sense that if you manage your time, you still have time for hobbies and passion projects on the side. So I got the best of both worlds.
That's awesome.
Fix this blind real quick, but yeah, you can continue.
No worries. I'll wait till you fix the blind.
Okay. Thank you. That was really going to bug me.
No worries. And I'll just edit that out later on. So I'm just curious to understand a bit more. You mentioned that you were guided by the social psychology lab, as well as you spoke to Dr. Bowen, and that helped you shift into psychology. I was wondering, were there any other factors or resources at Johns Hopkins that really helped you to make that decision-making process? And because I'd only imagine that the classes that you take for psychology is very different from something like writing seminars. So for those out there who are looking to potentially shift their majors, do you know what factors they should consider or what resources at Hopkins they should utilize in order to make that decision-making process?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that factored into my decision was that I felt like, as honestly, when I first switched to psychology, I felt very uncertain and panicky. What have I done? Is this irreversible? Can I run back if I feel like I can't handle the classes? Because like I said, I didn't have much of a good foundation in STEM in high school. So I was really worried. And honestly, my first psychology class was really difficult. I joined it a few weeks late because of my kind of snap decision. Oh, I want to see if I can try to do something different than I'd planned coming in. But what I would say is that really relying on mentorship with faculty, not necessarily the faculty advisor that is assigned to you, but for me, Dr. Bowen became mine. And honestly, because of his commitment to mentoring me and helping me through my thesis and other independent projects and analyses and teaching me every step of the research process and setting me up to be a grad student, really, I felt prepared to make the leap because I made that faculty student connection and mentorship. So that was a big one for me. Another one that made me feel really confident about being able to make the transition was knowing that Hopkins has the academic flexibility that even if I decided psychology wasn't for me, we didn't necessarily have a core curriculum. We have a distribution credit system, which means that you can take classes in certain required areas and concentrations, but not necessarily certain core classes. So I wasn't afraid also because I knew that I could always change my mind the next semester and I wouldn't have fallen behind because there's enough built-in room within each major to play around a bit and see what is the best fit for you academically. So I think because I had such strong mentorship and because I basically had a win-win situation, I felt comfortable exploring it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I totally agree that faculty mentorship is something that's very important because I know that for me, at least one of the projects that I've been doing is called A Quest to Learn. And had it not been for a lot of the faculty mentorships that I've received from the engineering department, it would not have gotten as far as it has gotten today. So you mentioned earlier that you're starting a PhD program soon at Cornell, which is awesome. But I'd love to know a bit more what made you choose to go into academia further, and what are the factors that helped you make that decision-making process?
Yeah, so I actually didn't decide to go further in my education toward the PhD route, that is, until probably the summer before my junior year. So until then, what kind of happened is my freshman year, I thought I was set on pursuing a master's in creative writing because I wanted to continue on that path. And we have an excellent writing seminars program here. So I wasn't too concerned about placement because they really help shape your portfolio so that it's really refined by the time you're applying to programs. And then my sophomore year, I didn't put too much pressure on myself to figure out what I wanted to do after Hopkins. And I just took the time that I needed to explore all possible routes. And one person actually ended up being really influential in my decision to pursue a PhD. And that was my friend. Her name was Maddie. And or to Chinat, our acapella group where we met, and she mentored me through a lot of things, whether it was being a psychology major at Hopkins or deciding to pursue a PhD program for continued education, or even joining a psychology lab, running an acapella group, even relationships in life. She was my mentor across the board, and she is now pursuing her PhD at Duke. So I learned a lot about what that looked like just from making connections with upperclassmen students who were 1, 2, 3 years ahead of me, if that makes sense. So it was good to connect with her, both while she was a student and a young alumni, because that was what really solidified for me, I want to do this. Also, just doing research at Hopkins, I had the opportunity to research with a couple of different psychology labs and to also work on various independent projects. And I also did a program with the Design Your Summer Experience program at the Life Design Lab. So between all of these different things, I realized that I wanted to continue researching and I wanted to pursue academia.
What a coincidence. I'm doing this podcast also through Design Your Life. experience at the Life Design Lab. But that's cool. Yeah, I think that definitely speaking to people who are older and just a couple steps ahead of you is really helpful, because they just gone through what you went through and you know what they're going to go through because you see what they're like right now. And so that's definitely another key takeaway that we could have for our audiences here. By the way, if you're interested in the Social Psychology Lab, I'll put the link down in the description down below. And so just feel free to access them through the show notes in case you're interested in what the work is being done there. Cool. With your academics, I know that you have very strong writing skills, and yet you seem to apply a lot of analytical and computational analysis to a lot of the work that you've done. Can you speak a bit more towards your experiences with that? Especially, it seems that a lot of people think that a lot of the analytical work with statistical analysis and writing some coding is very different from traditional writing skills. Can you share a bit more about your personal experiences and how you navigated that different skill set?
Yeah, so it was a bit of a difficult, not difficult, a bit of an interesting transition, because I think from the people I've met at Hopkins, a lot of people seem to either favor the writing side or the more quantitative, heavily math side. And for me, I had always been exposed to the writing side. So when it came time to building the computational skill set that I needed to get a quantitative summer internship or to even function in a psychology lab, I just had to take it one step at a time. So one thing that was great for me is that I started off by learning language coding, which means that you basically do linguistic analysis by assigning a certain number to each type of word in a phrase. And then you learn how to bridge the gap between the writing part that I was used to and also the quantitative analysis of language. So that was really helpful. And then from there, the great thing about the psychology department is it has this sequence of two courses that are research methods and design and statistical analysis for psychology. So you learn not only how to design studies and draft proposals for them, but also to design your own experiments and conduct them. And Dr. Bowen also teaches that sequence. And he was really good about helping students work through our programming just bit by bit through progressive tutorials. So I learned that as well. And also, I think the thing that's really important at Hopkins is being able to use your organization skills, both quantitatively and qualitatively. So I feel like that was another bridge between my writing skills and my quantitative skills, just learning a little bit more. I took an Excel class where I learned a lot more about just Excel's basic statistical analyses capabilities and also just its inner workings. And even though it was challenging, it helped amplify my ability to keep my schedule on track. So I think between those kind of three main categories, I was able to bridge those two very different areas.
What was the Excel class that you take?
So it was decision analytics, and it's in the Center for Leadership Education.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'll put that link and the course description and the course down in the description down below. Cool. I guess I wanted to ask a bit more about getting into that PhD program. I was curious to understand, was it difficult given your personal background and circumstances, or did you find that process to be smooth sailing? What was that journey like for you, really pulling that last leg for the PhD? Was Cornell your first choice, and how did you make that decision?
So I think my application process was almost anything but linear. I will say up front that I think the application journey was not necessarily my best in terms of mental health, just because I felt like the whole time I was getting ready to apply, even as I was studying for the GRE, it's now becoming more and more optional for a lot of programs, but it's still around enough that if you want to be able to apply to a breadth of programs, it's still a good idea to take it for the time being. But even as I was studying for that or working on my application essays, I just had this feeling like I was competing against this student who was exactly like my profile, but better and classier and way more qualified and more likely to succeed in their application. And it was horrible. I was dealing with this competitive workaholism against this unnamed, faceless other applicant that basically existed in my head. And I think that for the majority of the time I was working on my application, that was really hard for me to step back. I was dealing with imposter syndrome. Do I really deserve to get into a PhD program? Have I done enough? I didn't dive that much into research and devote so much of my time and attention to it until really my junior fall. And I was getting ready to apply to these programs heading into my senior fall. So I was wondering if that year was really enough to make me qualified. And that was scary. But at the end of the day, I ended up finding an excellent mentor through a program called Project Short. And it is designed for students from underrepresented backgrounds to find mentorship as they are working on either their graduate school applications or their applications to med school. So it's split into those two. And I had actually been talking with an upperclassman at Hopkins, someone who graduated a couple of years before me, who I actually met because I think I bought one of her couches as she was moving out to head to Stanford for her continued education. And she was a mentor for this program and was like, hey, you should totally apply. This might make your application journey easier. So that was great. And she gave me a bunch of tips. And then as soon as I started Project Short, I got matched within a week with this fantastic mentor who is actually an alum of one of the programs I applied to. So she not only had a lot of connections within the field, but she also was basically able to support me throughout everything, whether it was the mental health side of applications or the logistical side and just reviewing my essays. They work with you when you're a mentee on your personal statement, your academic statement, your CV and resume. They even have an option to help you with your interview skills because not every program does interviews, but I know for Cornell, I did have to do an interview. I didn't end up using their extra interview help, but I did work with my mentor on everything else. And she ended up connecting me to a lot of current graduate students in the programs I was looking at, and also current professors. And even if those first connections weren't the ones that ended up being the ones I applied to, or weren't quite the right side of the department, they were always willing at the end of the conversation to say, hey, I'll connect you to someone else. And even if it was by 3 degrees of separation, I always ended up talking to either the professor I was going to apply to work with, which was nerve-wracking, but also very useful because it helped me get a sense for whether they were A, taking students in the fall, which is so important, or B, interested in my work, because is that professor going to have room for you to grow? And on their current research agenda, is there room for alignment between your research plan that you've been running in undergraduate and where they see their work going? So those were very useful conversations. And I think they really showed how important networking is in any facet of life, even for grad school.
Wow. Thank you for sharing such a vulnerable experience. I think that definitely we all face our own insecurities and imposter syndromes, especially being at such a competitive school such as Hopkins. I think that a lot of people sometimes just don't think that they're enough. I know that I'm vulnerable to this as well.
Yeah, honestly, if it hadn't been for this class I took, positive psychology in the psychology department, Professor Halberta, it's awesome. I actually TA'd it last year because I loved it so much. But there was a unit on luck. And essentially the takeaway was lucky people create their own luck. And I took that and ran with it since my junior fall when I took the class. And the only reason I even applied to Cornell, which I never thought I would get into, was because I was living my life by that mantra. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll just go for it. And if I get lucky, all this hard work I put in at Hopkins will pay off and they'll take a look at my application and go, okay.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that definitely it'll be great if you share that positive psychology course, like guidelines with the show audience later. And that is something that is very important, thinking, finding ways to help you adjust and reevaluate. So I guess right now I want to dive deeper into the relationship side of things and just to understand, how have you managed to build your community, or potentially find partners during your time here at Hopkins?
So we're talking strictly romantic, or are you thinking also platonic?
Anything, both. Whether that is maintaining relationships with your mentors that you've mentioned just now, or potentially any kind of romantic relationships that you've found. Just essentially, how have you managed your relationships within the Hopkins community?
I think a huge thing is work-life balance and finding your own balance between managing your social circle and figuring out how big it can get before you feel overwhelmed. And then also how much you can take on in your classes and in your research and in your extracurricular commitments. I know for me, it was challenging because sometimes I do a little bit too much of the social stuff and not enough of the coursework. I always got everything done. I always maintained my grades, but I think especially during that semester of transition between majors, I really wasn't sure how to prioritize things anymore because my goals had changed. But ultimately, I ended up striking a balance where I would all day and get my stuff done. And then I'd make sure that each semester I had at least maybe a Friday off, and I would reserve a lot of time that day and on the weekends for hanging out with people. Now, that didn't mean that I necessarily had time to take a whole weekend off. I don't remember ever taking a weekend without doing any work, but I, at one point in my Hopkins career, had been fitting in my social life and the cracks between my responsibilities and extracurriculars and my responsibilities as a student. And that was just really exhausting. But even though sometimes it was too much social stuff and sometimes not enough, I think trying to get a day off of class is really helpful for students to find that balance. Now, in terms of maintaining a strong mentorship, for the less structured ones, like I'd mentioned upperclassmen mentors, it was just reaching out and asking for help when I needed it and checking in and seeing how their lives were without necessarily having a request whenever I had the time, because I never wanted those relationships to feel transactional, especially if they were my friends when they were undergrads at Hopkins. So I just kept in touch. And I think that served me very well as I've progressed through life and I'm heading towards this next step. Now, in terms of research mentors and professors, what I did was just keeping active. I kept asking questions. I kept asking for help. I kept asking them to take a look at this or that. I kept asking if they'd support this project or this conference abstract. And the answer was always yes, because professors get excited when their students are excited. I never felt like I was invading someone's very busy schedule, because I think the professors I worked with at Hopkins worked really hard to make sure they had that time set aside for students who were passionate. And they were really willing to help me, whether it was with letters of recommendation later on or with various projects. I was just, oh, this would be a cool idea. They'd always be like, yeah, we'll hop on and help with that. And then to answer the last part of your question with romantic relationships, I think it can be a little bit tough at Hopkins because everyone is very driven. Everyone has lofty career and educational goals. And it can be hard to prioritize a relationship and school at the same time, especially when it's scary. You don't know if you are going to both go to med school and then you have to manage long distance, or if you're one of you is going to med school, one's going to grad school, or one's taking a gap year, and how that messes with the application cycles. I know that for a lot of people, it really helped strengthen their relationships to have these conversations early on, but it seems to be an underlying stressor during such a transitional period of life, because even though in college you're taking time to grow, the idea of seeing somebody every day and getting to walk down to their dorm every afternoon and then all of a sudden you're long distance, it's stressful. But I think definitely a worthwhile conversation, which was spurred by just how exceptionally motivated the students here are.
How do you think your research in the social psychology department helped or affected your thoughts on relationships?
Yeah, I before had watched a lot of rom-coms and read a lot of romance and written a lot of romance. So it was interesting to get a new perspective. And now every time I see anything, like how a couple is holding hands, or I am listening to my friends and giving them advice, and they're talking about all these things that I've seen in my classes, whether it's social psychology class or stuff we've researched, it's crazy to see that all of this theory can be so readily applied to real, tangible relationships. But I think it has helped me give better advice. Obviously, I'm not a licensed therapist. I'm not able to help with situations. I'm not infallible. But it's helped me to understand and help my friends take more of an empathetic perspective when they're having issues, especially transitional issues or just relational issues with their partner.
You mentioned earlier that it can be tough to prioritize a relationship, especially when there are so many other factors and strings pulling at you at Hopkins. I was wondering whether you have potentially any tips or insights for our audience here, especially if they're making a decision on whether or not they want to commit to a long-term relationship, for example. What are some of the factors that they should consider, and how should that they make that decision-making process?
Yeah, first of all, the most important thing is communication, because I know it's very easy, and I've done this before too, to get in your head and start forming this other narrative and let your brain speak for your partner when you never even brought things up that they could easily address or make you feel better about. So it's so important to talk about your expectations, especially as they evolve with the relationship. And as you come to big moments like that, where you have to decide if you're going to stay together or if you want to even commit from a casual relationship. There's different types of transition, but I've found that communication is very helpful. Also, there are just certain expectations that are important to talk about, because I know some of us might have been raised and the parents are like, okay, the guy always opens the door. Whereas in some situations, the girl might say, hey, this is an antiquated thing. I can open my own door. And if she was raised to feel like that and her partner was raised to think otherwise, then it might be difficult to find a compromise if they're not talking about it. So I think overall, managing your expectations, understanding that every person you are engaging with romantically is a different person with a different upbringing and a different set of experiences from their own past relationships is just important for that perspective taking piece as well.
Yeah, I think that definitely finding and making sure that you both try and understand each other's background and past experiences and ensuring that the values are also aligning is important. So I remember you had an amazing birthday party that I got the chance to attend to. And you're also a great supporting friend as well. How do you think students can build the community around themselves, just like the way that you have? And how do you ensure that when you need help, that you're actually also able to reach out to your friends?
So the birthday party that China is referring to was not a rager, but a fun time. And it was about 40 of us crammed into a very small apartment that my friends offered to us. And it was a masquerade type game night. And it brought together a bunch of different friend groups. And this was about 2 months before the pandemic hit. So of course, after that, everything else became much more precautious in terms of health and safety guidelines. But back at the start of 2020, this party was comprised of the Mekki friend group I'd formed on the street / on social media before coming to Hopkins my freshman year. And then also my theater family from the mentorship program with the Barnstormers that I'd participated in for 2 years. And then it was also my a cappella group and my sorority and my other friends that I'd met at SoHop or other kind of pre-Hopkins, during Hopkins events. So it was just a random collection of everyone. And sometimes it can be a little weird because you don't know if mixing certain groups of people will work. Hey, it always worked at Hopkins because I think people are really open to having a good time when they're not in class. So that was also refreshing to find out. But I mean, I think the way that you develop those friendships that you really feel like you can lean on and then that you know that your friends can lean on is through just taking those kind of chance encounters. I remember there was one girl in my a cappella group I hadn't talked with much. I was a senior at the time and she was a freshman. And then one night walking on the route, we'd always drop each other off at rehearsal. Like the whole group would just gravitate and then we'd drop them off at the AMRs, the Carlton or wherever along the North Charles Street. And one night I was just like, hey, does anyone want pancakes? And this girl I hadn't talked to much goes, Yeah, I'd love some pancakes. And then that turned into a friendship where we now text every day. We're doing a two-person book club remotely, and it's been great. And I think
You were saying, sorry.
I was just going to say that it's just saying yes to those kind of last minute crazy experiences, or even just the simple things like making pancakes with each other that could form these great friendships.
I was going to say that I want in a book club. I want to make it a three-person book club if possible. I've been meaning to try and read books. Literally, Hong Kong just had the biggest book fair, and I saw a bunch of books on sale, and I bought a bunch of them. And so definitely I'd love, like, I've been trying to get back into reading.
All right. Well, it's all rom-coms. So
that's even better, right? Because I need to start filling out my tolerance for that kind of stuff. I remember really cringing really badly when we were watching To All the Boys That I've Loved Before.
Yes, that's a staple of the industry.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier that you were in a sorority. Can you elaborate a bit more about your experiences of being in a sorority?
Yeah, I was in Delta Xi Phi, which is the multicultural sorority on campus. It's broken down into the social sororities and the cultural sororities. And because of my mixed race heritage, I wanted to join one that was more culturally based, just so I could continue exploring that. And I ended up founding my own multiracial interest group later on anyways, but it was a good starting experience to meet people from different backgrounds, which is why I ultimately went in that direction. At the time that I joined, I was pretty small. It was only maybe 15 members, and maybe half of them were comprised of the seniors in my a cappella group, which were pretty much all female at that point. So I really enjoyed it. I had an awesome sorority parent who was really nice and always brought me a good mix of chocolate and popcorn, chips, and stuffed animals to my performances. He was just really supportive and always there for me. And I know that a lot of girls who have gotten involved in sororities, whether they be cultural or social, also had that really tight-knit experience of another form of mentorship. So it was a good experience, and I was philanthropy chair for a bit, so I had a chance to get more involved in planning the community service and outreach aspect of it. But one of the things at Hopkins that happens is we tend to overcommit ourselves and stretch ourselves too thin. So at that point, I was, oh gosh, I think when I decided that I had to drop something off my plate, that was the only thing at the time that I felt I could drop. So even though it had been a great community and experience for me, I just needed to be able to focus on the extracurriculars where I had bigger leadership roles to shepherd them through the pandemic when that hit.
Can you share a bit more about your experiences with starting your own multiracial group and how did that shape your community experience?
It shaped it quite a bit, actually. Before I came to Hopkins, as I'd mentioned before, I spent a lot of my childhood in South Dakota, which is really not very diverse racially or in terms of religion or just in many aspects. It was very homogenous. So when I came to Hopkins and I saw that there wasn't really a space for mixed race students, which is actually becoming more and more of the demographic itself is increasing, which is awesome. But I'm Chinese and Italian. And I was just like, whoa, do I join the Italian club? Do I join the Chinese Student Association? What am I supposed to do here? The interesting thing about being mixed race is that you're just enough of all parts of your identity that it's very hard to feel like you can fully relate to people who only have experience in one and have the full support of that community, because often we have such mixed experiences and such a blend of cultures. And we also don't necessarily look like all of our peers that we share identities with. Challenging to find yourself in that sort of environment. So even though both clubs were fantastic and I'm sure would have welcomed me with open arms, I decided to form my own multiracial group. And one of the great things about Hopkins is even though we have a ton of clubs, like over 400, if you don't see one of your identities or hobbies reflected in a current student group, you have the opportunity to create your own. And the process for that is you need to find 10 members, including an exec board. And I think they require president and treasurer at a minimum. And then you create a logo, you put together a guiding document, you get everyone together and say, hey, what do we want this group to be? How do we want it to represent us and our needs for community at Hopkins? And within about a year of me initiating that process, I just went to the Office of Multicultural Affairs and they got me started from there. Within a year and a half, we were an official student group. And honestly, having those conversations and having collaborations with other cultural groups at the Hopkins campus, or even a collaboration event we did with the University of Maryland's biracial, multiracial interest group, I found myself for the first time in my life talking about my experience as a mixed race person and seeing only nods of affirmation and, whoa, that's exactly how I feel, even though my background is totally different, but still mixed. And I hadn't experienced that before, because normally I'm the one who's sharing my experience and people are like, oh, that's cool. Tell me more about that. I can't relate. But finally, I was in a room full of people who were able to relate. And I really appreciate that Hopkins was willing to support that venture, because otherwise, I think as we've been growing, there's a lot of students who have been coming and having those same revelations and getting more invested in learning more about their own identities and heritages. So I think it's an important and safe space on the Hopkins campus now. And that is HAM Multiracial Interest Group. If you're interested in joining, they're always interested in welcoming new members to the community.
Yeah, and I'll put a link in the show notes down below to it. That's a very wholesome story.
Thanks.
And I use that word particularly because I remember you were the one who taught me that word. I never learned about it until I came about into the US, and then you keep using this word wholesome, or other people around me use this word quite a bit, and I had no idea what it meant, because I thought it meant just, oh, you're very full of yourself, like, what are you trying to talk about? Gradually, you helped guide me and eventually explain to me the definition of that word, which is great. And so I'm curious to know a bit more about your research into social media, because you mentioned earlier that you got to know a bunch of Meki people through social media and online presence. I was just curious to know, what do you think of this whole trend towards social media, and how has that impacted the way that we have managed our relationships and the people around?
Well, it's such an important tool, especially since 2020, with all of this virtual shift that's been going on. And even though we are shifting a little bit back more towards in-person now, I think that there's a lot to be said for the number of people who have invested time in social media and their social media networks just in the past couple of years alone. I've done a lot of research on social media, as I've told you before, which was the focus of my undergraduate thesis. I took some time to look into the literature because I'd read a lot about kind of mixed feelings. Some people think that social media is horrible and it's killing our IRL interactions. And other people think that it's great for building self-esteem and helping people create a version of themselves that's more idealized. They can see where they are and use it as more of a goal thing. So there's just so many different perspectives that I wanted to take a different approach and look at it from, what is social media doing to us personality-wise? How is it changing how we think about ourselves just holistically? So in my thesis, I looked at how people talk about themselves differently when they're thinking about themselves online, offline, and then just globally. And then I analyzed the differences between them. And I saw for some personality traits, people saw themselves as, hey, less anxious when they're thinking about themselves just online or just offline, as opposed to who they are overall, or feeling like nothing much changed with their extroversion and that they're just across the board introverted or extroverted. So there were a lot of insights that I think social media research is coming to find. And as more scholars are jumping into it, I think it's important that there be more translational ways for people who aren't necessarily going to be studying social media, but to think about how these practices can be applied to their own lives, which is why I'd encourage people, if they have the time and the opportunity to take the psychology and social media course through the Department of Psychology, also taught by Dr. Bowen, another shameless plug, because it was what got me thinking about this path, but also it got me thinking about my own social media use too, which was, I think, beneficial for my mental health.
You really love Dr. Bowen, don't you?
I love him as a mentor. He's awesome.
So I guess on the other spectrum of things are like messages. And I know that you have a great habit of writing physical cards. What inspires you to write these kind of cards and maintain these kind of meaningful touches for people?
Apart from wonderful cinematic masterpieces like To All the Boys I've Loved Before, it's something that I've done growing up. There's different forms of accounting. There's the ones that you do on social media that are just digital, or things that you can send to people in Messenger. I like to use a mixture of appreciation posts and direct messages online, like open letters like, hey, I love you, you're a great friend, thank you for making me and my life better. But I also really the personal touch of the tangible cards, because even though we can store so much infinitely online, we can really, there's something to be said for the personality you can see in someone's handwriting and knowing the time they took, bent over a little card to just say, hey, thank you, you're a great person in my life. So I think that even though it's not as frequent anymore, I still like to write birthday cards and thank you cards and hey, I like you a lot, you're an amazing friend cards. So I think it's just, it's a cute little touch, and it's something that people can put on a wall or keep in a shelf. I know some people to collect them and just read them over when they're having a tough day or something. So it's nice to have something you can physically hold in your hands to affirm you, I think.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that another, speaking of which, another thing that I recall doing with you and as part of our a cappella group was that we would have these cards or these papers where we would write like one good thing about all the other members about us. And then that kind of affirmation paper was really important to me, because there were bad days where I was like, I feel so terrible about myself. But then I look back on what everybody else in the a cappella group felt about me. Or for example, I felt insecure about my own personal music talents and that kind of stuff. And through the affirmation of the community around me, that helped me keep me going, which is amazing.
And for everyone listening, for the record, Chinat's an amazing beatboxer and rapper. Ask him to do some Hamilton for you sometime.
Yeah, I'll definitely do it. Especially if you say that Ria asked you to do it, then I'll do it.
Yeah, references podcast.
Exactly. You got a green ticket to your show, personal show.
Hey there, I've got one favor to ask you. Share this episode with one person who you know would benefit from it from the Hopkins community. If you're on YouTube, show us your love by subscribing and smashing the bell icon below and commenting as well. We can't wait to read your reviews on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Any suggestions for us? Feel free to leave it there. Go hop! Hey there, I've got one favor to ask you. Share this